Welcome, my name is Rainer. I'm a business owner and manager in Austria, and I talk to other business people about what makes their job interesting, about learnings they have, and about what they do. On today's episode, I will talk to Alex Bernard. Alex is a private equity frontier markets investor, meaning he directly invests in countries that have yet achieved little economic development. Alex will tell us about what makes his job interesting, what he does, the challenges, but obviously also the opportunities. And he will give us an outlook on what coronavirus might mean for the developing world. Enjoy. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Rainer.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Greetings from Singapore.
Greetings from Austria. So as the listeners can hear, we are not sitting together. We're doing this remote, which is a direct consequence of coronavirus, of course.
We had the buzzword. This is the world we live in.
So we got rid of that buzzword from the start.
Perfect. So if somebody was playing a drinking game and they have to do a shot every time somebody says coronavirus, that would be the first shot.
I promise there won't be too many more shots. Don't worry. So, Alex, you are a private equity frontier market investor. What the hell is that?
I guess that is a little bit of a mouthful. So it's, I guess, two different things combined together. One is private equity, which is a concept in and of itself that you may want to unpack a little bit. And then the other one is frontier markets. That's its own particular subgenre of investing. So private equity, for those who are familiar.
So private equity. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is this caricature about private equity that is that they would come in and slice up companies, fire everyone, and leave behind a trail of devastation. So I guess this is exactly what you're doing, correct?
Oh, absolutely. All day, every day, just slicing and dicing. No. So I think you started that statement very correctly by referring to it as a caricature, because that's what it is. That's what people think about based on some books that they may have read about certain specific private equity transactions that were famous in the 1980s, right when private equity was really just getting started. And the idea at that time for some of those private equity investors was that there were these kind of large bloated conglomerates, because the 1980s was an era of combining businesses and creating bigger and bigger business platforms spanning across many different sectors. It was sort of the era of the conglomerate. And then these private equity investors came in and realized that a lot of these conglomerates were really not running efficiently at all, and that a lot of the different businesses that had been combined had no logic at all to the combination. They had no relationship with each other. There were no synergies. And so private equity firms came in and bought into some of these conglomerates and then sold them off piece by piece. And I think that's where that particular caricature comes from. But today...
That's what got you intrigued about private equity.
I can certainly tell that evoked your interest. I can certainly tell that's what got you intrigued about it, Hannah. just from the line of questioning here. No, so today, private equity is really very different from that. Most private equity now is focused on buying a particular business and running it more efficiently, or in some cases, not even buying the whole business, but only buying part of it, maybe buying 25% or 30% or 40%, just enough to have a board seat and to have some influence, with the idea being that you, as the private equity firm, have some idea as to how to actually either grow the business, so actually grow the top line, grow the revenue, and make it a bigger business through that kind of a growth-oriented strategy. Or, of course, in some cases, it is still geared towards identifying inefficiencies and finding ways in which a company maybe is not being run in a smart and efficient way. So then perhaps you're not actually necessarily growing the top line, but you're doing certain things to increase the profitability of the business. that happens as well. But the idea that you're either going
to... Sorry to interrupt you. There's one very important rationale, and this will become important later when we go to the frontier market aspect, to simply provide the capital that is necessary to grow.
Right.
So quite often a company might have a good idea on how to grow its business and how to become more profitable, but it doesn't have access to the necessary funds.
That's very true. A lot of businesses traditionally will raise money by taking out loans. But there's, of course, a couple of challenges with that. First of all, sometimes you might not be able to take out a loan, maybe because you already have taken out too many, or because your business just isn't considered bankable in a traditional sense by the banks, and so they're not willing to actually give you a loan. So that's sort of the one scenario. Or you might just be too early stage, and so it wouldn't be really smart for you to take out a loan, because you don't really actually know if what you're doing is going to generate revenue fast enough to pay down the interest and the principal. And so in both of those cases, you might actually prefer equity instead of debt. And that's definitely also one function of private equity.
Okay. So I take it you are rather specialized in the quote-unquote not so evil part of private equity. So
your business
model is rather to invest, to grow, to provide capital, and to take a share in companies. And obviously the term private equity refers to not on the stock exchange. So you're not buying shares, but you're buying shares, but you're not buying public traded shares.
That's exactly right. So that is focus of private equity generally, is to invest in privately held businesses, or in some cases to invest in public equities, but actually just buy the whole business and do a so-called take private transaction, where you take a business off the stock exchange and turn it back into a privately owned business. So I'm focused specifically on what is generally referred to as growth equity investing. So it's where you actually invest equity into a business with the purpose of growing it. So growing the revenue, growing the top line, you know, growing sales. And in our case, because we're focused on frontier markets, which is, I guess, now kind of getting to the second part of your question, what is frontier markets private equity? So frontier markets are a subset of the world's emerging markets that are essentially the least developed ones, the ones that are still the most poor, you could say, the most underdeveloped. You know, in the past, one might have referred to these as third world countries, but today these types of countries are generally called developing markets, and so those are the ones that that I focus on. You would find these mainly in different parts of Asia and Africa, some parts of Latin America.
Could you name us a few countries that you would consider frontier markets, as opposed to emerging markets?
Sure. So when most people think about emerging markets, the first ones that come to mind would be countries like China, Brazil,
right.
India, South Africa. These are some of the larger ones. In fact, some years ago, one of the financial institutions came up with the term BRICS to refer to the emerging markets, the B standing for Brazil, the R for Russia, the I for India, and the C for China. And then the S in BRICS, some people add that in, and then that's South Africa. So those would be the traditional emerging markets. These are the ones that are a little bit bigger markets. These are the ones that are a little bit more developed actually already. So if you were to look at their per capita GDP in these countries, you would see that it's a little bit higher. It's obviously not as high yet as Europe or the US, but it would be moving more towards middle income status. That's the traditional emerging markets. Now, if you go from emerging to frontier, you start to talk about countries like in Africa, for example, Ethiopia, where mm-hmm. we have done some investing. You would talk in Asia about countries like Mongolia or Cambodia or Sri Lanka or Uzbekistan. Really, any of the stans actually would be considered frontier markets. So these would be countries where the per capita GDP is still very low. So people are still fairly poor. And also these would be countries that are still not as connected to the global economy. They're still a little bit on the periphery in some ways of the global economy.
Right. So how does one invest in Ethiopia? I mean, I guess we have an understanding and a picture of how private equity in Europe or the US works. You'd have probably specialized people trying to find deals. So how do you do that in countries like Ethiopia? How do you do it in countries like Mongolia?
Yeah, in the United States and in Europe, and to some extent even in China and India, these more developed emerging markets, private equity is very professionalized already and very systematized already. So you have different players that are serving different functions within a transaction. You would have investment banks, for example, a Goldman Sachs or a Deutsche Bank or a JP Morgan, and they would be talking to companies and they would be actually finding opportunities. So they would be so-called intermediaries that would be identifying potential companies that need capital and then packaging the pitch very cleanly so mm-hmm. that you can see all the information about the business in a very nice presentation, and you can see the financials and the whole story is already nicely packaged. And so then,
so it's basically a la carte. It's an a la carte system.
It is. So then a private equity firm would go to JP Morgan and would say, you know, look, I'm interested in finding a healthcare company that produces certain types of medical devices, maybe, you know, that's my focus. And what, you know, what do you have right now?
And right. In theory, you could even say, I want to buy into an Austrian label business. That could be, I think that would be a very good idea.
Yeah, this is a very, very, very interesting example and a very surprising example that you would be mentioning here.
So my background is I'm running a business printing self-adhesive labels and packaging.
Yes.
For disclaimer, I'm using this as a sales pitch.
Very good. And why not? And why not?
Why not? Why not? You know?
yeah. So that's how it would work in terms of sourcing a transaction in a developed market. And then you would hire a accounting firm like PwC or Ernst & Young, which would help you with your financial due diligence. They would probably already have an office in the country, and so they could do a third-party analysis of the company's financials for you, and then you would also hire a very competent law firm that would give you advice on how to structure the transaction and do the legal due diligence, and everything is pretty well set up to do a private equity transaction.
It's basically the more the market is mature, obviously, the more the private equity market is mature. But what I would assume is that also results in quite strong price competition and competition for deals, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're exactly right.
Especially in this economy where basically you have more capital that is available and less interesting deals, because we have an economic crisis. At the same time, the central banks are pumping in more and more money by the day. So you have a lot of cash sitting around looking for deals. So I assume for private equities in Europe, it is becoming increasingly hard to find good acquisition targets.
I think in general, the easier it is to find deals and the fewer barriers to entry that there are, the more there will be competition and the more you will see basically auctions for assets that drive prices up. Because everybody is talking to the same banks, everybody is pretty much seeing the same deals, and then it becomes either a price war or it becomes some kind of a beauty contest where you have to convince. I mean, for example, in your case, Reina, you just said that you know, you have a label business and a packaging business in Austria. It would be a beauty contest of private equity firms explaining to you why they would be the best partner. And so, you know, maybe one private equity firm is actually offering you a slightly lower price.
Don't worry. I would go for you. Don't worry.
I was really hoping that you would say that. And I hope you mean that more than just in terms of the private equity relationship.
I have some other
ideas I want to talk to you about later. I think that's right. And so, of course, in frontier markets, you have the exact opposite phenomenon, which is that there are no investment banks that are intermediating transactions. You do not at all have yet a professionalized, systematized private equity industry. So you need to go in and you need to basically build relationships yourself with local business people to find deals, which means spending a lot of time in country. It means spending a lot of time making friends with people, having drinks with people, going to conferences, going to events, and building out your own organic business network that you can then use to source deals. So on the one hand, of course, that makes it a lot harder because of all this legwork that you have to do. But then the flip side of that, as you already correctly pointed out, is that you have a lot less competition because there's just not so many people that are willing and able to do that type of legwork. And so once you're there and once you have the relationships, you're able to negotiate much more attractive prices for these assets because there's just simply less competition.
Right. So let's assume I wouldn't be a packaging producer in Austria, but I would be in Ethiopia. And I need to raise a substantial amount of money in order to follow my growth perspective. I would probably have a hard time finding a bank loan. We'll get to that a bit later. But when I'm in Austria, I would probably go to an investment bank and say, look, find me some private equity investor that wants to have a 20% share in my company. Whereas if I'm in Ethiopia, there isn't such a bank. On the other hand, you as a private equity company, you cannot go to a bank and just ask for available deals. So basically what you're doing is you go upstream and insource some of the earlier points of the value chain.
That's right. Absolutely. I think that's a very good way to characterize it. And really, by doing that, not only are we accessing very interesting deals at very attractive pricing, but we're also serving an extremely important role in the market because without capital, you cannot achieve your growth plans, right? I mean, it's like a beautiful plant that's getting sunlight, but it's getting no water. That's just going to stunt its growth. So it's the same. Here with businesses. You would have a label company in Ethiopia that simply cannot access the capital that it needs to buy the new machinery or to invest in that new facility that it wants to build or expand with additional warehousing. And so we're able to come in. We're able to negotiate an attractive price when we become the partner and buy 25 or 30% of that business. But then we're also able to put water on that plant basically and unlock that growth and serve a role in the market that at the moment in countries like Ethiopia and in other frontier markets just isn't being served properly yet.
I think this aspect that you just mentioned can hardly be overvalued. And it was very surprising for me when I researched on the issue and upfront talked to Alex about it. We are so used to the idea that meaningful business or a business that is financially solid in Austria, in the US, in Europe, has access to loans. I mean, we do know there is a problem for startups to get enough venture capital, at least in Austria and in Europe, probably much less so in the US. But we are very used to the idea that if you're a good business, you make a profit, you have a financial track record that is promising, and you have new ideas to expand your business and pay back the loan with the revenues of this expansion, that you would get access to the loans. And okay, the interest rate could be very low, or it could be medium, or it could be higher, but usually you would probably expect to get access. That is not the case in large parts of the world. Like in Ethiopia, there is hardly any access to loans if you, say, want to buy a new label machine and pay back the loan with the revenues of labels. you would need a collateral that is basically land or some fixed asset that you can guarantee the loan with. So basically, you only get money once you have money, and few people have money because obviously a country like Ethiopia is quite poor, unfortunately.
And you actually saw this with your own eyes, Reina, because I remember you and I took a trip together to Ethiopia some years ago, and we actually, just out of interest and curiosity, met with a guy that was running a small label business, and he pretty much explained exactly this to you, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, it was a very impressive personality, actually, a former Canadian student, and he had scrapped together his last bits of money that he inherited, and I don't know, we were probably talking $30,000 or something like that, and set up a business with that. But obviously, most people in Ethiopia don't have access to that. And also, successful businesses can only very slowly grow their business at the rate that they can finance it from cash flow. And this is obviously a problem for development. So this is a very interesting aspect of Alex's private equity firm, because this firm, in some way, delivers financing to an area that is not used to having it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So Alex, I mean, this sounds very interesting. Like, what types of company are we talking about? I mean, I guess you don't invest in a 20,000 euros label business in Ethiopia. I guess you need a certain minimum ticket size. What types of companies are those?
Yeah, so it's been changing a little bit over the years because we're investing now in bigger and bigger companies and making larger and larger investments. But back a few years ago, we were generally doing 5, 10, maybe $15 million investments into companies, and we were buying 20, 30, 40% equity stakes in these businesses. So that gives you a flavor for how big the company is. You know, if we're investing $10 million to buy 40% of a business, then you know that's a business that's worth just over $20 million. So that's sort of the types of investments that we were making a few years ago. And these sound like really, really tiny businesses, but actually for these frontier markets, these would be very classic mid-cap businesses. This is sort of, I guess, for your Austrian audience, this would be the Ethiopian Mittelstand.
So you've heard it. You've heard it. Alex speaks perfectly German, but makes me record this video in this podcast in English.
Just because I can say Mittelstand does not mean I speak perfect German.
It is a nice Mittelstand, though.
Thank you so much. Okay. that's the type of businesses that we were investing in. And in terms of sectors, it was really pretty broad historically. We were investing in a lot of very basic consumer-focused businesses because one of the really important stories that we're seeing across the frontier markets is the growth of the consumer segment. So there's mm-hmm. just more people that have more disposable income, and they're spending that disposable income on buying more and more basic consumer products, not necessarily luxury products, but you know they would be buying more bottled water instead of drinking tap water. They'll start consuming more milk. If they have the ability, they will start using a private hospital instead of a public hospital. They will start sending their children to a private school instead of a public school. So these are the sorts of things that we're investing in a lot. And then the other area that we were investing in quite a lot was building materials. So basically everything mm-hmm. that was an input for all of the infrastructure that is being built. Because in the frontier markets, that's sort of the other really big story, is that as they grow and as they shift from becoming really underdeveloped markets to markets that are sort of moving up that development ladder, one of the first things that governments especially are investing a lot of money in is building better roads, better bridges, you know, better infrastructure. And we generally didn't want to invest in the infrastructure itself because those are huge capex intensive projects, and oftentimes those are actually government projects. But what we right. were invest, what we were investing in is the companies that supply different inputs. So the cement or the concrete companies or the glass manufacturers, all of that sort of stuff. So that's what we were doing. Today, we're still doing some of that, but we're also now making much larger investments because we're now part of a larger private equity firm called Cerberus, and we have access to larger pools of capital. So now we're investing.
For the Austrian audience, Cerberus is a private equity firm that has bought BAWAG very famously,
right?
When it was almost bankrupt, and in the meanwhile, it is doing very well. Obviously, there are many, many branches of Cerberus. It's a very big private equity firm, and Alex is in the frontier market branch of Cerberus, if that is the correct term.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So I, together with my business partner, he and I run the frontier markets platform within Cerberus. So now that we're part of Cerberus, we do much larger transactions. We do 100, 150, even, you know, $200 or $300 million investments. Nice. Which means that we're now investing not only in mid-sized businesses, but we're also investing in some cases in some of the largest businesses that exist within these frontier markets.
So basically what you have a team on the ground that tries to find deal to cover up for the upstream part that is missing, and you try to find deal, invest in them. And these used to range from $5 to $15 million, and now they would rather be in the segment of up to $200 million.
Right, right. And our teams are one of our key differentiators, which allow us to do these investments. I mean, like you said, we have people on the ground, either in the countries, or if they're not in the countries, then they're near the countries. You know, I'm in Singapore right now, which we use as a hub for our Asian markets. We have a hub in Dubai as well, which we use for some of our African markets. So we have people either on the ground in the country, like in Ethiopia where we do, or in Mongolia, or for some of the countries where we don't actually have people on the ground, we cover it through a regional hub, and we just make our people travel a lot. So if we're deciding that we want to focus more attention on, say, Sri Lanka, then we use people that are in our Singapore office and we start cycling them through Sri Lanka. Every month we might make somebody spend 1 week or 2 weeks on the ground, cycling through, to really start to build that network and build those relationships. So that's absolutely one of the key differences if you look at our business versus some of the other ones. And that's the kind of legwork that you need to do if you want to source deals in a frontier market context.
Right. So basically, I imagine you have to build up trust first, because private equity, as I presented the caricature at the beginning, I would assume also in the markets you're going to, many people have that view and are probably reluctant to work together with an American company.
You do. You absolutely have to build up trust. A lot of the business people that we talk to in these markets, they've either never actually heard of private equity before, or if they have heard of it, then to your point, oftentimes what they have heard is this caricature. So we have to spend a lot of time educating people about what private equity is, explaining to them exactly the type of private equity that we do, and really building that relationship and building that trust and spending a lot of time doing that before we actually get into a real transaction with them. So trust is incredibly important. And then, of course, reputation is incredibly important, because the business communities in these frontier markets tend to be fairly small. It's not like the United States or right. you know, Germany, where there could be thousands of businesses and the business owners don't even know each other. In Ethiopia, you would have a much smaller number of business owners, and they would pretty much all know each other. And so if you do something to really violate the trust of one of your key business partners there, it's going to really sour your reputation in the entire market. And so, you know, we make sure that we're very, very careful with our reputation, because we understand that that's something that is absolutely fundamental to our ability to do business.
Right. That was also one striking aspect to me that in countries like Ethiopia, you would have a rather small or very small group of entrepreneurs, so to say. And my theory why that is obviously that very few people have the capital to start with to do any meaningful business, which is something you try to mitigate by sending more capital there. But this is obviously the starting point. Now, my question would be, how do you enforce your contracts in a country like Ethiopia? Now, I obviously don't know enough about the judiciary system, but I would assume it is much harder to enforce a contract in Ethiopia and Mongolia, and there is probably a higher degree of corruption than in Europe and the US. How do you deal with that? How do you make sure that you get your money back at the end and that people follow the rules?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very important question, and it's a complicated thing. So you have to do various things. I mean, frankly, it starts with choosing the right business partner. And, trust goes both ways. I mean, on the one hand, we have to build trust with these business people, and we have to be very careful of our reputation. But actually, if you have good business people in these markets that you find and that you partner with, then they also want to build trust, and they also are very worried about their reputation for the same reasons, right? The fact that it's a small market, people know each other, and word gets around fast. And in many of these countries, the top business people, their reputation is also extremely, extremely important to them. So a lot of it has to do with finding the right people and partnering with them, and then just making it very clear to them that they have made certain commitments and that you expect them to uphold those commitments. They understand that. I think some people in the US or in Europe have a view that when you go into these frontier markets that, basically everybody's a crook. But that's really not the case. I mean, as in any country in the world, you'll have, good business people and bad business people, and you'll have people that care a lot about their reputation and people that, care less. So you need to make sure that you're finding the right business partners. That's part of why also just investing the time to get to know these markets and to really get to know people is so important. It's not only to be able to source deals, but it's also to make sure that you're sourcing the right deals. If you just kind of fly in and out of Ethiopia twice and you meet some guy and then you invest right in his company, that's very, very risky. But if you really get to know the place, you get to know the business community, then the people that you're investing with, you'll have a much better sense of who they are, who they're connected to, and whether they're part of that virtuous circle of business people that actually care about their long-term reputation. So that's really key. But then, of course, the other thing that's key is structuring your deals in a way that gives you maximum protection. And there's various things that you can do, including moving certain parts of the corporate structure outside into jurisdictions that are more reputable jurisdictions. Like, as an example, if we invest in Mongolia or even in Sri Lanka, really any of our Asian jurisdictions, we might put the investment company in Singapore, and then we and that business partner, we actually become partners in Singapore, so that if there's a legal dispute, that legal dispute gets handled in Singapore under Singapore law.
Right.
So there's things like this that you can also do, and a whole host of other mechanisms, so-called consent rights that you build into your contract, where your consent is needed for certain decisions, where you might have additional oversight over the finance function. You might even have the ability to appoint the CFO, even though you're just the minority investor, because in some cases that finance function might be a heightened concern. So there's a lot that you can do. It's complicated, and you really have to tailor it also to the particular worries that you have for that specific investment that you're making.
I think it was a very interesting point that you made at the beginning, that the reputation of the business owners is very important to them, obviously. And they would not want to treat you badly, because then their business partners in the country know that you were treated badly, and then they in turn would punish them in some way, or not punish them, but not make deals with them in the future.
Yeah, it's two things.
And sorry, I think for that reason,
to cut in, I think it's just to very quickly cut in on this. I think it's partly their reputation in the country, but then it's partly their reputation outside too, because they know that you're an international investor,
right,
and you're connected, and they know that if they screw you and screw you badly, anyone else who ever invests in that country with them, the first thing that they're going to do is call you and say, "Hey, I'm thinking of investing with this guy. What do you think? What kind of experience did you have?" So they know that's the case, and and so that's an aspect of it as well.
That's interesting. So how does one become a private equity frontier market investor? I mean, I assume there are not too many other private equity companies doing exactly what you do, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. That's part of our
part of the appeal.
Sort of, part of our appeal exactly is that we're doing something that's fairly differentiated and where there's not that much competition. How does one become this? I guess there's probably no single standard path. but in my case, I started out as a corporate lawyer doing private equity from a legal standpoint, working with other big private equity firms as a legal advisor, helping them structure transactions, mainly in emerging markets, not really in frontier markets, but I was advising on transactions in India and advising on transactions in other larger emerging markets as a lawyer. So that's how I started. And then slowly, I made my way over from the legal advisory side to the actual principal investing side. So that was sort of my particular path. But a lot of other people, you know, they come into private equity either with an investment banking background or a consulting background. And there are people that that do consulting work in frontier markets. There's, you know, McKinsey is very active in Asia and Africa, so you might find people that worked with McKinsey in some of these markets that then they want to get into actual private equity investing in the frontier. You know, or you might find some other people that were doing investment banking. Again, probably not in a place like Ethiopia, but they might have been doing investment right. banking in a place like South Africa, and then they kind of try to transition from that over into frontier markets, private equity. So there's no one path, but you know, you would need to have certainly some understanding of how private equity works, and you would need to have some understanding of these types of markets.
Right. In your case, I can say that you obviously have a very strong interest in international policy. I know that because Alex also published a lot, and that certainly helps in assessing the market like Mongolia.
Yes. For me, I have always been interested in business and investing, but I have also always been interested in geopolitics and in macroeconomics.
Right.
And for the particular markets that I focus on, these frontier markets, that combination turns out to actually be a pretty useful combination, because geopolitics and macroeconomics are much more relevant in some of these frontier markets for your investments than they are in, say, the U.S. or in Europe. You know, U.S., just to take the U.S. as an example, you know, U.S. is a very stable political system, and you don't need to be some kind of political wizard to make good investment decisions. You know, in the country, you can really focus on just the business merits of a particular investment. But if you're going to be taking a bet on an investment in Sri Lanka or on an investment in Mongolia, there's a lot more political and macroeconomic analysis that you have to do, because the range of political and economic outcomes is a much wider range. There could be
right.
a revolution. There could be political turmoil. There could be a collapse of the right. currency. There could be some other geopolitical events because of, for example, U.S.-China competition that pushes the country one way or pushes it the other way. And so,
That being said, you don't have as many publications, or at least the standard journals one might read, don't cover the Mongolian inner policy on the same level as the U.S. Obviously,
that's also true. Yes.
So you need to do your own research in some way.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, that's very interesting. So you how then did you become responsible for private equity frontier markets investments at Cerberus?
Well, a friend of mine and I, we were running our own smaller private equity firm that he had actually founded and that I joined at a fairly early stage, and we became partners in that business, and we were growing that business together into more and more frontier markets. We had been focused initially a lot on Ethiopia, then we added Mongolia, then we added Georgia. So we had these certain markets that we were focused on, and we were on the cusp of adding even more markets and growing it into an even bigger platform. And then we were introduced to Cerberus about possibly partnering in some way. And one thing led to another, and in the end, Cerberus actually decided to purchase our business and fold it into the broader Cerberus platform, and that's how we became Cerberus Frontier.
Okay, so basically, you were bought by Cerberus.
Yes, we were bought by Cerberus. Cerberus at that time was already thinking of expanding more into emerging and frontier markets. They thought it was an interesting area. They thought it was an area that had a lot of potential in the future. And so when we were introduced to them, I guess it was a very fortuitous coincidence that they were already thinking to expand in this way. And then they decided that by acquiring us, and by making me and Gabriel the Gabriel's my business partner, by making me and Gabriel the co-heads of their frontier group, that we could expand their emerging and frontier market strategy more rapidly.
Okay, that sounds like a win-win, ideally.
So far, so good.
Because obviously, Cerberus obviously has very different access to capital, I assume, than a rather small in comparison private equity firm.
Right. Yeah. No. That's one of the big factors that made this appealing for us, and also just a strong cultural fit, mm-hmm. and a strong feeling that Cerberus not only had these pools of capital that would be very valuable, but also capabilities in terms of knowing different sectors very well, and in terms of knowing different transaction structures very well, which if you combine that with our expertise, we felt that we could do a lot more in frontier markets than we were already doing.
Okay, cool. So now I imagine you are sitting in Singapore. Your investments are in Ethiopia, in Mongolia, and many other countries. How did coronavirus hit you? I mean, you cannot travel there, I guess. That's one aspect. But the other aspect is obviously capital in times of economic crisis tends to get shy and move back to the home turf, so to say. Is that what you see happening, or how did coronavirus affect you?
So here we have the second mention of coronavirus.
So that's
another
your second shot.
second shot for people. So look, I mean, coronavirus has had a very significant impact on our business, because it's had a very significant impact on our markets. And I'm talking actually mainly about the economic impact, although the health impact has also been very tragic. But actually, there's some reasons why the health impact, in some respects, has been actually less than in Europe and the U.S. But setting the health impact aside for a moment and looking at it through an economic lens, the virus has been devastating because, unlike the US and unlike Europe, the markets that we focus on do not have the ability to do huge amounts of fiscal and monetary stimulus to plug the gap. They just aren't strong enough governments. Mm-hmm. They are not financially deep-pocketed enough to do that. They don't have access to international capital markets in the way that the U.S. does. I mean, the U.S., you know, can just raise debt basically by snapping its fingers, but the markets that we focus on, you know, cannot do that. So there's no ability to do the fiscal and monetary stimulus. And then on top of that, as you correctly pointed out, there's always in these sorts of times a flight of capital, private capital, out of what are perceived to be risky markets and into what are perceived to be the safe haven markets. And right. we're seeing that this time on an unprecedented scale. So the capital flight, both equity and debt, out of the emerging and frontier markets, and the retrenchment of that capital in the US and Europe is even greater than the global financial crisis. It's the single largest outflow of private capital from emerging and frontier markets that we've witnessed basically in a lifetime. And so you combine all of those things, and what that means is that these markets are getting hit very hard economically. Hmm. The flip side of that, of course, is that there is a very interesting buying opportunity right now, because when you have that kind of flight of capital and when there's no fiscal or monetary stimulus to prop up the asset prices, then asset prices drop, and they drop, you know, much more than they're dropping in the US and in Europe. And what you're seeing actually in a lot of our markets is a far truer, in some ways, reflection of what the real asset prices are, versus in the US and in Europe, where you're seeing actually a bit of an inflated view of asset prices because of all of this fiscal and monetary stimulus that's been pumped into the
crazy.
System.
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, the stock market in the US, I don't know exactly, but it's still very high, whereas the economy is going bust. Right. So that means that prices of companies have gone up relative to what they would be worth in the past.
Yes, and earnings are going down. So you're actually seeing price to earnings ratios in the U.S. going.
That's the term.
Yes,
I mean that's the term I was looking at. Yeah,
exactly. Yes, I mean, so you're seeing price to earnings ratios just going to levels that that are far outside the norm.
So basically, your rationale to invest in frontier markets at this point is to say, look, yes, they were hit harder probably than US and Europe economically, but that also reflects in the asset prices.
Yes.
So that's a good buying opportunity at this point, and I would assume this is also your sales pitch now that you raise money.
That's right. And in fact, you just said it so well that next time I call an investor, I'm going to conference call you in, and I'm going to have you say it that way again.
No, I think you should just, what I would even prefer is to just share the podcast, and they will learn everything they need to know about frontier markets.
Even better.
That sounds very interesting. But at the moment, I guess you have a problem to even visit the countries. I mean, can you go to Mongolia, and is it realistic that you can go there anytime soon?
You're reminding me of a very depressing fact here. Look, I mean, it's very tough right now. Traveling internationally is very tough, just period across the board.
Right.
But traveling internationally to these markets is even tougher, and I think unfortunately is likely to remain tougher for a longer period of time, because what countries like Singapore are beginning to discuss and are beginning to consider are these so-called travel bubbles, where Singapore puts in place maybe a bilateral agreement with, for example, South Korea, or a multilateral agreement with South Korea and Japan. And these countries agree to adhere to certain health and safety protocols in respect of their travel. And then by adhering to those protocols, they agree to make travel easier again between those countries. But these travel bubbles are much likelier to develop among developed countries, among high-income developed countries that have good health infrastructure and that trust each other. So Singapore may trust South Korea and Singapore may trust Japan and therefore agree to this travel bubble. When you start to go into the frontier markets, you go into Mongolia or you go into Indonesia. Mongolia, by the way, not to go down a rabbit hole, but Mongolia actually did a fantastic job with coronavirus and is one of the shining stars globally in terms of how they managed it. But setting Mongolia aside, if you look at Indonesia or the Philippines, you know, if you look at these sorts of countries, very unlikely that Singapore in the near term would agree to these travel bubble arrangements because Singapore just
Who would blame them? I mean, to be honest,
yeah.
Who would blame them? I mean, probably there's a general mistrust in the reporting coming from those countries, with maybe good reasons or not, but probably on average it is justified. And the other problem is obviously it's not very high on the priority list. I mean, the Ethiopian economy is tiny as compared to any other major economy. And obviously, why would Singapore or Europe risk having another outbreak for such a small economic impact?
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree. So that's the problem. And
that being said, you still have your people on the ground. I mean, you do telcos with them and so on, but it's just that you personally or your team from abroad cannot travel to those markets.
Yeah, we have our people on the ground. So in the markets where we have already a physical presence, you could actually make the case that now we're at an even bigger advantage because
no one else can fly in.
No one else can even fly in, exactly. Mm. And then for the markets where we don't have people on the ground, we're just learning to navigate this new reality with the same way everybody else is, I guess, with Zoom phone calls and, you know, trying to kind of push things forward remotely. But it's tough. And frankly, until some of these travel restrictions start to ease, our business will face some fairly significant logistical challenges in terms of identifying and closing new deals.
Yeah, that makes sense, absolutely. But it's probably the best... It's probably the best time now to research new deals and prepare everything to hit the ground running once the dust settles.
Yes, and that's what we're doing. We're spending a large amount of time doing research, having internal strategy discussions, thinking through exactly what all the implications are of coronavirus, not just in terms of next month or the month after, but what are some of the lingering implications? What are some of the ways in which coronavirus might change consumer behavior in our markets? And what does that mean in terms of which businesses we would want to support and which businesses maybe we would be less enthusiastic about now?
That's very interesting. But basically, your outlook for the future in frontier markets, if I understand that correctly, is that yes, the economy will take a stronger hit, but the prices will adjust for that. So if you invest correctly and wisely now, you have actually a very good growth perspective for you and your investors and for that reason also for your company.
I think if you believe fundamentally in the frontier and emerging market story, then there can be no better time to invest than now. If you don't believe in emerging and frontier markets at all, and if you just don't think that they're going to be important in the future, and if you look at the statistics and you're just not convinced about the fundamentals of emerging and frontier markets, then you know it is what it is. But if you believe like we do that there are things that are going on in emerging and frontier markets that are significant and that are not going to change, meaning massive population growth higher than anywhere in the West or in the developed world, much higher GDP growth, a shift in share of total GDP, a shift in where production is happening. If you believe in all of those things, then now is the best time to invest in these markets because prices are going to be at rock bottom.
Very interesting. That was interesting to hear. I mean, it's I still have a hard time imagining you buying, I don't know, in a milk company in Ethiopia, but that's exactly what you do. And I think this is super exciting. And again, what one cannot underestimate is the economic impact that this type of investment can have, because so many companies in these markets are well run. They have good ideas. They have good growth perspective. They have a huge market at their disposal. But what they are lacking in is simply cash and to fund their projects. And that's where you chip in. And I think that's very beautiful. Thank you very much for taking the time. It was a great pleasure. So I think we had probably 3 or 4 shots that people had to drink because of coronavirus. We'll keep that. I think we'll keep that as a tradition for the future. No, but it was very interesting. Thank you for making the time, and all the best with your endeavors.
Thank you, Rainer. Same to you, and always a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
In today's episode, I learned a lot about private equity investment, frontier markets, how the two can be combined, and what the challenges are. If you liked it, please share this with your friends and tune in next time. All the best.